Hey, Rich, have you played College Football 25 yet?
You know what, JJ? I made the mistake of telling myself that I wasn't going to go next gen until the next GTA game comes out. So unfortunately, I won't be playing until my children have children. What about you?
Yeah, that's a terrible, terrible idea because GTA is not coming out for another 15 years. I booted it up last night. I am playing as the Bowling Green Falcons. They're going to go to the promised land. Tarion Stewart is their running back. And Tarion, I know you're out there maybe becoming a best ball bro yourself. Let me tell you, you're going to be a Heisman winner this year.
I'm JJ, and I've been playing in best ball leagues for years. But there are people out there who play a lot more than I do, and there are people out there who have won a lot more than I have. And I want to learn from them. This season, I'll be documenting my journey of max entering Underdog's Best Ball Mania contest. And I'll be doing so with guidance from some of the most successful best ball players on the planet. This is the year where things start to change. This is the year where I officially become a best ball bro.
Welcome into another episode of Becoming a Best Ball Bro. I'm JJ Zacharyson, joined as always by my co-host Rich Ryan. Rich, what's going on, man?
Doing good, man. I have a quick, very good NCAA story. My freshman year in college, one of my very good friends, my guy, Mike Dodson, incredibly good at all video games, especially sports-related games. He was also an incredible athlete in Virginia on a state championship football team. He got invited to the high school combine, actually, but had never done any lifting before. So he ran in like the low fours, but he didn't do a single bench press. Zero. Didn't get the bar up. So they were like, all right, Dodson, get out of here. But ironically, he was actually living with the Elon football team our freshman year. And there were a lot of guys that started chirping him because he thought he was so good at NCAA, this, that, and the third. So one of the football players actually challenged him because he thought he was the best. So my buddy Mike Dodson dusted Shane Gillis one night.
Wow.
In NCAA football.
Wow. Shane Gillis, what a name
obviously
drop.
Goes on to be one of the biggest comedians. We don't keep in touch with him. He left Elon quite early. But yeah, if you're out there, Shane Gillis, Mike Dodson smoked you.
I had no idea that Gillis was an Elon guy.
Fellow Elon, man. Bro.
Man, that's crazy. I'm really interested to see with College Football 25 to see how like the players react to fans. Like I'm going to become a fan of these random Bowling Green players, and maybe one. I have no clue if any of them are like on the prospect radar, right? Like Tarion Stewart. I have no idea if he's good or not. He's fun in the game, and I'm using him. I have a 90% pass rate so far with my offense. We don't run the ball. We're not. But out of the backfield as a receiver, he's awesome, and that's why I think he might end up, you know, winning the Heisman. But it's gonna be really, really interesting to see how all these players who are now in the game and we get to know them that way and know of them, how sort of that relationship's going to work with fans and players.
And Underdog always keeping their fingers on the pulse, dropping Best Bowl Mania today, college football, which, JJ, I will not be partaking. I'm just not good when it comes to unprofessional sports. You know, I've got enough time on my hand.
Unprofessional.
I've always called, that's always anybody who follows me on Twitter, Irish G. Ryan, I've always called them unprofessional at the college level.
Yeah.
Which is now actually not factual because these guys are getting paid as they should be. True. I do not, Saturdays are for the family. And then Sundays are for consuming an unhealthy amount of professional football.
Yeah, that's how I've always been. Like, people ask me like if I'm going to do like college football content or like what my Saturdays are family days. It's a choice by me for sure, but I also think that it's only fair, and I'm not going to like, you know, it wouldn't be fair to my wife with two small children for me to just be sitting on the couch for both Saturday and Sunday during the fall. That's just bad husbanding, right?
It's already bad enough where one day of the week.
Yes, right. It's already pretty. When you got an almost 6 year old and a 1.5 year old running around, like, you can't. That's not good fathering and husbanding. But yeah, I'm not gonna dip my toes in that at all. But I do think that if you're a college football fan, And even if you just want to learn the game a little bit, there's going to be people across the internet, I'm sure, doing lots of content for that. And you should join. I mean, if you're into college football, definitely check that out over on Underdog, because I would imagine there's not going to be many places that offer what Underdog's going to offer for college football.
I think the edges will be a little bigger too in college than in NFL because of the lack of content, like you said. And just in general, when you look at sports betting, larger edges tend to come in, I'll say it, collegiate sports, not unprofessional, than they do in professional sports.
Yeah, I mean, there's not going to be a lot of people that have any idea what's going on, really. And there's a, you know, a lot of it too is that there's just a wide range of teams and players that you need to understand and get to know. And there's not this like database of, oh yeah, we've seen this guy play for 5 years and we know exactly, you know, unless it's Tyrone Tracy who played in college for 18 years. You know, you're not going to know, you know, who these players really are because they're either freshmen, we've never seen them in college football, or, you know, they've only been around for couple of years. So the people who are studying that stuff definitely are going to have an edge.
All right, we had some big wide receiver news today in the NFL. That's right. Quintez Cephas signed with the Houston Texans. out in the Bay Area.
Did he really though? Did he?
Yes, that is an actual thing that happened.
Nice.
Shouts to the Cephas family. Out in the Bay Area after weeks of kerfuffles and social media strife and his brother posting things, Brandon Ayuk has officially requested a trade from the San Francisco 49ers. That's according to Mike Garofalo. Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that he will get traded? Who are the suitors? There's a lot of speculation going on right now, JJ. And we know, we've said this repeatedly, and we'll keep saying it, that uncertainty drives value in the market. So what does this trade request as we enter what is the uncertain period of will he or won't he go, and where will he go? Where will any value be driven out of this, JJ? How will this change the way that you're drafting right now in best ball?
I feel like there's probably a 5% chance, maybe even less, that he gets traded. And I think the logic behind that is, you know, he's requesting this trade right now. Well, why right now? Well, camp's about to start. You know, there's an actual tangible thing that's about to happen, and he's trying to use that as leverage. But also, look at the state of the 49ers. And the state of the 49ers is they're one of the most competitive teams in football. You know, looking towards the future right now, with one of their most important pieces offensively, who is one of the best wide receivers in the game, you know, it wouldn't make that much sense to swap that for draft capital or something like that, which is what you would be doing and getting in a Brandon Ayuk hypothetical trade, right? I think this is just a negotiation tactic. Just because he requests a trade does not mean the 49ers are going to trade him. We see trade requests all the time. Deebo Samuel, I believe, requested a trade whenever he was going through his stuff a couple years ago, and that never came to fruition. He stuck with San Francisco. I could be wrong though, if he did or didn't, but you know, we've been through this before with other players. Now, should you be open to the idea that he does get dealt? Yeah. And I think that if you look at the landscape in the NFL, there's probably, you know, maybe one or two teams, like maybe a Buffalo or something, where if he were to go there, and I'm not even looking at cap or whether this is feasible or not, but there are very few teams out there where this would be a neutral move from a fantasy perspective for Brandon Ayuk or a good move for Brandon Ayuk. Like, San Francisco's a pretty good spot for him, despite the fact that, you know, they're going to be run heavy. You know, he might not see like a 140 target type ceiling. The problem is the two teams that he's linked to most are Washington and Pittsburgh, which are two teams that if he goes there, man, I mean, we're talking probably like late third round type ADP for Brandon Ayuk. That would be my guess. I mean, that's a round where you start to get a little bit more ambiguity, a wide receiver, you know, maybe where like Zay Flowers goes, another wide out who's in this, like, you know, a run centric offense who, you know, we don't know that much about him per se. Like, Ayuk is a better player than Zay Flowers, but situationally it would be even worse in one of those two spots than what Zay Flowers is seeing. So maybe he'd be above that tier a little bit, right? Like mid third to late third. Because I do think Ayuk is one of the best wide receivers in football, like top 10 to top 15. And so maybe top 10. So, you know, if he goes to Washington, if he goes to Pittsburgh, that would be bad. But I'm planning for him to stick in San Francisco. And if his ADP falls, I'd be okay with snagging him. The problem is, I don't know how much it's really going to fall, because the alternative here, like I said, would be an ADP in like the late third, and that might not be so big of a risk for people to not draft him there. Like if we were to know that he would go in like round seven or something like that, if he were to be traded, I bet that his ADP would fall pretty dramatically from where it is right now, just based on this news. Like just based on like he would go to like the mid third, like maybe early third to mid third. I just don't know if it's going to change that dramatically because he is a good player.
What about Kittle and Pearsall? Because I would lay $2 to one that we see Ricky Pearsall's ADP move up half a round next time this week. This time next week, excuse me.
Yeah. I think it's going to happen. You know, Kittle maybe might move a little bit. Kittle's ADP seems to fluctuate a good bit from draft to draft. You know, like obviously you get an ADP number, which is the average, but I wouldn't be surprised if his range is relatively wide in terms of where he gets drafted, because sometimes he'll fall into like the mid seventh. Sometimes he'll go at the 5-6 turn. You know, he's kind of everywhere. But yeah, I mean, I think that we might see maybe more of those 5-6 turn Kittles. The one problem I would say is that there are a lot of drafts where Kincaid will fall to the late fifth. And so there might be less of a need for a team to kind of go that route and get Kittle. But yeah, I think Pearsall is the one that people are going to make the connection with most, because it's a wide receiver. He's a young, talented guy. He would be the one stepping up and immediately seeing work, maybe in two wide sets right away, but at least down the stretch, he probably would. You know, they also have like a Juwan Jennings, who's at least a solid player. I actually think that's not a bad idea either to play off of. This is like 18th round Juwan Jennings, right? Like if you're building a 49er stack and a Lions stack, or that week 17 game, you know, just throwing that dart might not be a bad idea if you want to play against this Brandon Ayuk situation a little bit, because realistically Jennings isn't the worst dart throw in the world, I guess, in the 18th round in a stacking environment.
Ball watchers know Juwan Jennings can go out there and get it.
Yeah, and like they like Jennings. I wouldn't be against kind of going that direction and working against the market a little bit, unless the market's like, no, we're going to draft Juwan Jennings in the 16th round. Like that would be a little bit different, but I highly doubt that happens.
I like that pivot a lot. I like that way more than Pearsall sneaking up to like the 11th round. If you look at current ADP, so there's this group of receivers, Gabe Davis, Jalen Polk, Jahan Dotson, Xavier Leggett, and then there's this group of running backs, Dowdle, Lloyd, Chubb, Miller, Chandler, and then Pearsall is after that. So just naturally, I think Pearsall is going to gravitate closer to that group of receivers, and then it's going to be making a decision between those receivers and Pearsall, who there are going to be people out there that sell themselves on the fact that, oh wow, he's going to be the number two receiver in a Kyle Shanahan offense. It's going to happen. Like, I got to click this name.
Yeah, no, I think it's going to happen. I think we'll see a rise, but we could see a contract get finished up in the next week and things just change immediately.
Yeah. And you made great examples earlier, specifically with the Debo request, but then also last year we saw Bosa get his deal done right before the season started. And I mean, Ayuk has been there forever. He already has rapport with Brock Purdy. How much is he really going to be contributing and learning and improving in preseason? So, yeah, I'm with you that I think this has a low chance of actually happening. Speaking of camp, we've got all these camps opening up. There's going to be a wave of information. Clips of people making one-handed catches and being spectacular and all their people being the worst ever. So throughout that process, JJ, how do you go through information and try to discern what is meaningful, what is not? Most importantly, what is predictive and what is not?
Yeah, I think that one of the things to differentiate is if a beat writer is speaking about talent when you can do the talent evaluation yourself, like that's one thing that I'm not as interested in. Like if they're talking about a guy who's just like crushing everyone else in practice or something, like just keep in mind that that's a subjective view. It doesn't mean that they're always wrong. Like it could be a very valid point, but at least take that with more of a grain of salt as if it's like a talent-based evaluation about a player. What I'm more interested in is, especially when it comes to backfields, is how they're speaking about the coaching staff liking or not liking a certain player, right? Or if they believe a running back is going to see more work than, you know, what's being projected just by the masses and, you know, naturally. Like one of the easiest example of this that I threw out there last year a lot and really you know, it got me off of Cam Akers, but not on Kyren Williams, unfortunately. Pre-season starting. But was Jordan Rodrigue from The Athletic, who was talking about Kyren, like pretty consistently talking about Kyren Williams having a bigger role in that backfield than people realized, and that Cam Akers was not going to be necessarily a bell cow back. And so I wrote about that in my draft guide, but it was more of a me throwing Cam Akers on the avoid list, you know, because he was like a fifth round pick last year, as opposed to me saying, hey, go out there and draft Kyren Williams, which, you know, the way the season started, I think that was the right advice after like week one. But then once week one hit, we were throwing that dart at Kyren Williams after his week one performance. And then Cam Akers gets traded and, you know, Kyren Williams, the rest is history. But those are the kinds of tidbits that can help, is that you're looking at what these beat reporters are saying about how a team might deploy a player. Like, that's very interesting. Like that, you know, whether it's like, oh, they might like forget about like, oh, they're going to use this running back in the slot a lot. Like that doesn't, we know historically like that doesn't happen that much. But
every
if they're
year,
like
every year, hey, we're going to line them up outside.
Yeah. But if they're like, hey, this wide receiver who traditionally plays perimeter is going to play more in the slot or vice versa, like that's going to get me to investigate a little bit further and look at that player in more detail and say, well, can he play that role or not? And then the last thing I'll note about training camp news, if there are negative reports, that's a big deal.
That is it. That was the one point I was going to make. This is it.
Yeah. Negative reports are because there's going to be a lot of fluff pieces. There's going to be a lot of optimism and positivity from beats because it's, you know, everyone's energetic and excited about the upcoming season. But if there's a negative report about a player, that's generally not that great of a thing. You do want to pay attention to that thing, to that kind of stuff. But again, a lot of this, you know, when you look at the and take a step back and look at fantasy football more holistically, as I always say, talent is more, it drives the wide receiver position more than the running back position, because wide receivers, and I even say this in the interview today with our guest, but wide receivers need to go out, they need to get open. There's more talent involved in playing that position to get volume, which is the volume that we need in fantasy football. With running backs, it's a coaching decision at the end of the day. I mean, of course, we want talent to win out and coaches to get reward talent and give them work. But at the end of the day, a coach can say, I want to split this backfield. I don't want to split this backfield. Like, and if they do or they don't, then that will result in whether that player is good or not in fantasy football. And so because that is a subjective human decision, the coach's decision, I will listen to a beat writer to say how they think a backfield might be split. Now, be wary of the beat writers who like start to project stat lines because they generally don't know what they're doing from that perspective. And I'm not like calling anyone out in particular here. I'm just saying I've seen many stat lines out there from beat writers. They don't know how to build projections. Like they just don't do that, right? But if they're saying, hey, this could be a 50-50 split between these two running backs and the market is saying, no, it's going to be a 70-30 split, pay attention to that. Like there could be something to that.
Yeah, and camp usage and formation information becomes even more interesting when they do these inner squad scrimmages, because these teams have kind of punted on the preseason entirely. Like, they don't take these preseason games very seriously at all. But these inner squad games, I feel like they take those very seriously. And they're in a safer environment. The quarterback still has on the red jersey, so you're less likely to have some injuries. So I think that's when a lot of the positional stuff becomes extra interesting. And then, the negative information. You got to think about the job of a beat writer and the economy that they live in. They're basically satellite employees for the team. They may not be employed by the team, but they sure as hell need that team to like them, to remain in their orbit, to continue getting sources, to continue to get availability. So when bad stuff comes out, that means a coach or an assistant, likely maybe off the record, fed them that information and is okay with them leaking it out to the public.
Yeah, it's important. And the formation stuff, like you said, is really important too. Like if we, you know, with your Jets, if we see that like Malachi Corley isn't playing with starters in the slot, like he isn't their primary slot guy and it's Xavier Gibson, then we should be paying attention to that because that means that Corley might not be getting early season production and we got to wait a little bit. Do you want him to wait on your bench or do you want him to wait on your waiver wire and you just pounce on him instead of using that roster spot? Like those kinds of things and nuggets are very, very important.
By the way, I think Corley is a Scott Fishbowl dart throw, by the way. I think he could be a demon in the return game. But that's just my my Jets bias creeping in.
Yeah.
Speaking of running back, you've been drafting running backs in the fourth round, specifically a Super Bowl champion and a man that you propped up as a seventh rounder, Isaiah Pacheco. Keep chopping, Rutgers.
Yeah, I've needed... So this is one of my focuses this week, if not the only focus. I think it is the only focus, yeah. Fourth round running backs. So like Travis Etienne, Isaiah Pacheco. Pacheco is the one that scares me most. And I say scares me because I have not been drafting these guys nearly enough. And the reason for that is team structure and team builds and roster construction. I often in the fourth round am panicking a little bit and saying, oh, I got a running back in the first three. I can't go non-running. I can't get another running back here. That's going to be a little bit scary. Or, you know, I end up going with a tight end or a quarterback, and I'm looking for like one of those stacks with like Lamar and Mark Andrews or what have you. And the problem is that, like, you know, we've said this before, but if there's a position that's going to fall in drafts, it's usually running back, right? Like running back is the one that, and quarterback too, whenever they're not stacked and such. But, you know, running backs will fall in drafts pretty frequently. And so in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, I don't need to get Etienne or Pacheco here at ADP because, you know, I'll have other drafts where they fall, right? But it's not happening as much as I'd like it to happen. So moving forward, and even like today a little bit, I'm trying to draft a little bit more Pacheco. The problem is that Pacheco's ADP is rising, right? So this was a failure on me trying to become a best ball bro and my read on Isaiah Pacheco in general, because, you know, it's kind of going in the opposite direction of what I would want in order to get more exposure. And I think that as more casual drafters come in, we're going to see, you know, whenever I say casual drafters, I'm not saying that in like a derogatory way. Like I genuinely mean it as like you are just playing this more casually than I am, let's say, right? And when people who aren't playing as many lineups and you know, entering as many contests and stuff, when they join, I think they're going to be shocked by the ADP, and they'll probably influence that a little bit by drafting these running backs a little bit earlier. And so I wouldn't be surprised if like Pacheco is a 3-4 turn guy by the end of July, and that scares me a little bit. So I'm still probably going to force it at least a little bit, you know, over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, last 2 weeks he's gone from 47 to 45 to 43. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot, but in these upper rounds, you know, two spots here, three spots here is massive, you know? Yeah. And you made the point previously about the delta between where Pacheco is going to go in your home league and where he's going in best ball was massive at one point. And that gap is starting to narrow. So your opportunities to get him are slipping away, JJ.
Yeah, I know. I gotta just force the issue a little bit. I don't need to be like 10% with Pacheco, but I'd like to be at like the 6-8% range, I think.
All right, let's talk about some specific players. Then another running back, which was discussed last week on this show, the Eagles' own Saquon Barkley.
Yeah, he's fallen a little bit in ADP where I'm getting him at the 2-3 turn. I've paired him with CMC. If I see him in the 23 overall spot after getting CD Lamb, I'm immediately stacking CD Lamb with Saquon Barkley for that week 17 correlation. And so I'm getting some Saquon. Now, I know that others are not as into Saquon in the space. Like I was on ADP chasing yesterday with Sam Sherman, Davis Maddock, and Pat Corain. And it sounded like Davis and Corain were not very high on Saquon. And part of the reason was because they're very high on Devon Achane, which I'm with them. I like Achane more than Saquon. My thing is I'm getting Achane at times still, you know, into the third round, right? Whereas Saquon, I don't think is going to necessarily jump, you know, I don't think he's going to jump Saquon at any point. And so, like I said, when more casual drafters jump in, I would bet that Saquon's ADP rises a little bit because they're going to be so weirded out by the fact that, you know, we're drafting freaking Jalen Waddle over Saquon Barkley, which I've been doing all summer for the record, but they're gonna be freaked out by that. And yeah, I mean, like I think that with Barkley, and we talked about this a little bit last week, we have to be open-minded about how this season could go down for Philadelphia. There's a lot of moving parts. Like there are more moving parts. Like I think Saquon and Jonathan Taylor are pretty similar backs from how they're gonna score. slash the kind of environments they're in. You get these mobile quarterbacks, good weapons around them, you know, hypothetically good offensive situations, but they might lose some of the goal line work. Maybe their target shares aren't going to be that high. But I would say I think Saquon's target share still has the potential to get into that like 12% range and maybe even 13% range. Like, it's possible. They have a new offensive coordinator there. That's not something that's happening in Indianapolis. Like, we know how Indianapolis is generally going to operate, whereas things could change. And there's variance in Philadelphia with Kellen Moore there. And they could be more pass heavy. And that's not a bad thing for Saquon, in my opinion, because if they are more pass heavy, there could be more volume through the air going his way. And that's been something that, you know, I know his efficiency metrics might not show it, but he's a good receiver out of the backfield. Like, he's been playing in a really, really crappy environment for the last few years of his career. So, you know, this is also a running back that they haven't had, you know, in with Jalen Hurts. Like, say DeAndre what you want Swift, about how they
DeAndre Swift is like dollar store Saquon Barkley. All right.
Right. Like, like, say what you want about DeAndre Swift and their usage of Swift. It's like, okay, that's not Saquon Barkley. Like, they're not the same. That's not the same kind of running back. And he's not nearly as talented. So I am intrigued by the variance involved with Saquon to the point where now that he's at the tail end of the second round. Yeah. I've been clicking his name.
Let's talk about another player who switched teams this offseason, and that's Jerry Jeudy, who is now with the Cleveland Browns. And you were interested in not just Jeudy, but the entire Brownie offense right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, so we've said enough about Jerome Ford. I'm not gonna talk down more on Ford. Like, he's not someone that I'm like super, super actively going after. But I do think the receivers are interesting. I've gotten plenty of Amari Cooper. You know, this year, obviously he showed off his ceiling last year on a weekly basis. He had that monster outing last year. But also, you know, you're looking at, Deshaun Watson, who I think is undervalued as a fantasy asset. If you look at how he actually performed in games where he was healthy last year, not that bad. His point per game production was really not that bad at all. And you're getting at least a little bit of mobility and a little bit of rushing upside with him too. But I think the Browns are pretty strong offensively. You look at their weapons, you look at their line, you look at what they could do. They might be a little bit more pass heavy this year. I think they will be more pass heavy this year with the offensive changes that they made. And then, you know, there are times in your draft where you want multiple outs for stacking, right? Like earlier today, I did a Best Ball Mania draft where I had a Bills stack. I actually had Josh Allen, who slipped like seven spots past his ADP, so I drafted him, and then I got Dalton Kincaid at ADP with my next pick, and then James Cook fell into the like well into the sixth, and I was able to get James Cook as well. So I had this locked in Buffalo Bills stack, and I also had DK Metcalf earlier, so I drafted Jaxon Smith-Njigba in the seventh, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna be going after Geno Smith more than likely. But as the draft went on, I wanted more outs with that lineup just in case. And so in that lineup, I had Jamar Chase, who they do, Cincinnati gets Cleveland in week 16. So I had Jamar Chase in that lineup. And I said to myself, okay, well, I'll at least have like week 16 correlation if I draft Jerry Jeudy, but also I'm getting this out of getting another stackable quarterback potentially if someone annoys the you-know-what out of me and drafts Geno Smith a round and a half ahead of ADP. So Judy's just one of those guys where I think that he's probably properly valued. Like, I don't think that he's like this screaming value, but he's had some marks throughout his career that are pretty favorable. He obviously was a really, really good prospect. Maybe he just needed this change of scenery. Like, you can tell yourself a story as to why Jeudy could have a decent season. And then you layer on top the game theory component. And that's why I've been going after Jeudy a little bit more.
Browns have a massively wide range of outcomes, right? They had it last year as well, and then Deshaun has the shoulder injury, and it sent the whole offense into S, and Joe Flacco had to come in off the couch and save the day. I think that range of outcomes remains wide entering into this season. We're not far removed from Deshaun Watson being unequivocally the third or fourth best quarterback in football. Yeah. Now, a lot has happened since that occurred, but there could be something in there that makes him way closer to league average than he's being drafted right now. Like, he's a trash bag. So yeah, right. There definitely could be value on Deshaun Watson. And then finally, the RB4-5 cluster you want to discuss with Kamani Vidal, Marshawn Lloyd, Jalen Wright, Ray Davis. What you got here, JJ?
Yeah, look, I just really like this rookie cluster. And they all generally go in the same range. You know, Marshawn Lloyd is creeping up a little bit and he'll go earlier than these guys. We talked about him last week, so I don't want to, you know, get into that anymore. But like, you get Marshawn Lloyd, Kamani Vidal, Jalen Wright, Ray Davis, all of them. You know, you got Vidal, who's in a situation where he could like be the 1A realistically in this offense by the end of the season. I think that he's at least going to be a good tandem partner for like a guy like Gus Edwards. You get Jalen Wright, who has multiple injury outs with Devon Achane and Raheem Mostert. He's in arguably the best running offense that you can find in football, given the scheme. I think he's a really good scheme fit. You know, he's a bigger bodied guy compared to the other two backs there. And he's got a ton of speed, just like the other backs there. But like I said, he's got multiple injury outs. And I also think that Jalen Wright could have some standalone value in like garbage time, right? Like, what if he's their RB3, they're up by 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter. He might get some usable weeks just based on garbage time as well. So that's another reason why I like Wright. And then Ray Davis, you know, I know I said that I drafted James Cook. I'm not drafting James Cook that much. They were more run heavy with Joe Brady, a lot more run heavy last year, Buffalo was. And so I do think they're going to use Ray Davis and James Cook a pretty decent bit on the ground. And Davis could slip right into that like Latavius Murray role that we saw last year with a little bit more upside, because I thought Davis was a pretty decent prospect. And what if he's just better than what they had out of Latavius Murray, which I don't think will take that much. You know, I don't think Murray's like horrific, but you know, I don't think it's not like he's a superstar, right? And so Davis could step in, you know, get some production there. I would have drafted him. I already took James Cook in my Bills stack, but I've gotten Ray Davis in plenty of Bills stacks. Because you get the contingent upside of a James Cook injury, but also I think there's going to be some standalone value there for him.
To bring it full circle, I can't wait for camp reports with regards to Kamani Vidal, because I feel like these other players have pretty defined roles, at least right now. Whereas Vidal, yeah, we're looking at three backs. Who has any idea how the Chargers are going to deploy these three guys? New coaching staff, three new dudes, like...
I know, and I'll say this about Vidal, is I think he might be a camp superstar because he's that kind of shifty player. Like, he's a really dynamic, fun player from that perspective because he's smaller. Like, he's only like 5'7.5". Like, he's a very short back. He's smaller, but he's got a lot of weight to him, kind of like a Jaylen Warren, you know, size-wise and stuff. But he's a great pass protector, a really good receiver, and he's got that acceleration and speed. And so I could see him winning over beat writers in camp, which is why I've loaded up. He's one of my highest rostered running backs so far.
Are you calling it right now? Is he going to have the Amir Abdullah run in preseason that lights the world on fire?
Look, I think Vidal, I'm not going to be shocked if Vidal's like a 11th rounder in best ball drafts by the end of August. Like if he rises, you know, maybe we'll see him. Maybe 11th round is a little bullish given the running back environment on Underdog, but I think that he can definitely jump like or like enter the Jerome Ford area or like the Blake Corum area, right, of drafts. Like, I think that's definitely feasible.
You mean league winner Jerome Ford?
League winning Jerome Ford. Anyway, all right. I did have an interview earlier today with Mark Garcia. It was a really, really fun interview. I think it gives you guys a different perspective on best ball. He's another high volume player. He runs the best ball product at 1 week season. He also contributes to Fantasy Points, Roto World, and Player Profiler. Lots of game theory talk with Mark. He had an interesting stance on quarterbacks in best ball that I think a lot of people are going to sort of think twice about. But it was just a really enjoyable conversation, really sharp guy, and I think you guys will enjoy it. So without further ado, here is my interview with Mark. This episode is sponsored by Underdog Fantasy. If you haven't played over at Underdog yet, now's the perfect time. There are tons of different best ball leagues that you can join, and there's definitely a league out there that fits what you're looking for. And you can use all the things that I've talked about with guests on becoming a best ball bro to crush those drafts. But like I said, now's the right time to join up. Because if you go and you sign up and use promo code LATERound, you not only get a nice deposit offer, but you also get a free late round draft guide. That's a $25 guide emailed to your inbox after signing up for absolutely free. So head to underdogfantasy.com, sign up using promo code LATERound, and make a deposit. I can confirm, It's a really, really fun platform to play on. Now back to the show. All right, Mark, I got a question for you. How solved is best ball? I know that that's kind of like worded strangely. I had this in the show sheet, and when I sent it over, I was like, I hope this makes sense as a question, but how solved is best ball? Like, do you think that drafters right now might be a little bit overconfident in sort of how they're structuring their teams and how they're going about that and draft in, draft out?
Yeah, I think 100%. If you think about the way that we visualize this concept of like the total potential outcomes in a game, we use in game theory something called a game tree, which is a visual representation of like all the potential paths you can take on a game. I mean, we'll take like the most basic form of game theory in games, like rock, paper, scissors. There's three different moves, and there's three different moves your opponent can throw. So we have this very tight matrix of the game tree where it's like rock on rock, or rock on paper, rock on scissors, and so on and so forth, right? Think about best ball, where even if we constrain ourselves to like six picks around a draft pick or extend that to 12, the game tree is borderline infinite. So like this idea that we have an idea of what is optimal or what is required to win these contests, like, you know, we have things that describe what is won in the past, but we really don't know. We have no idea what the optimal path on this year's game tree is going to be. So it's on the order of magnitude, even if we constrain ourselves to 12 picks around an individual draft spot. Say we're at the 12th pick. If we say we can draft the six players before and the six players after, we're on the order of magnitude of like 3.9 to the 12th power of like the total number of combinations that are in this game. We have an idea of what will boost EV, like roster construction stuff. We know we should be correlating week 17 because that's the highest contributor to expected value. There's all this stuff that we use. And the reason we use expected value is it removes things like variance. It removes things that we can't control. But even within that, like there's only so much we can control.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, from that perspective, then we do have sort of these builds and these roster constructions that seem to be go-tos in a way within the space, especially over on Underdog, where people are going very, very wide receiver heavy. So you see a lot of these zero RB teams, which I don't even know how we define zero RB anymore, especially over there. It's like it's such a weird sort of economy and what's going on over there. But then there's like anchor RB and those kinds of teams and such. What has been your favorite way to differentiate with team structure? And sort of on top of that, do you think that there is this overconfidence in the way that folks are looking at zero RB and saying this is the way to draft based on, you know, what we've seen, you know, over the last 4 years of Best Ball Mania? Like, do you think that sample size is far too small for us to say this is absolutely how we should do this? Or, you know, I know that I'm rambling here with this question, so we can take this piece by piece. But, you know, like we do have season long fantasy football, which is not super unlike best ball. Obviously, best ball is a different beast to some degree, but there are plenty of similarities because it's fantasy football and it's generally playing the same game. Do you think that we have enough of the concepts from there that they do trickle over, that we do know that beyond just these best ball mania contests, that going anchor RB, for instance, is actually sort of an optimal thing that we've seen through the years? Or do you think that we should just throw it all out and say, all of this analysis is really over analysis and there's just way too much variance involved, and the way that we need to draft here is to differentiate two things, whether that be, you know, who we're picking in the player analysis side, but also the team structure side. And maybe instead of going with zero RB and hero RB, we go with three running backs to start a draft.
That's a very, very complex and in-depth question.
That was the worst question that an interviewer has ever asked on a podcast. I totally get
why I say that is because like the answer is probably just as complex, right? Yeah. From a theoretic perspective. So there's two big things that kind of from a theoretical perspective facilitate this idea of zero RB. It's the fact that we know that production at the running back position is most heavily tied and correlated to volume. We also know that running back is the most oft injured position. So those two things play nicely to say like, hey, there's a lot of variance at the position, but we know that through that variance, we're able to capture production on the back end of it by that position's value being so closely tied to volume. So that kind of leads us into this idea like, oh, okay, like I can leverage some of that variance in my favor by going zero running back and trying to leverage some variance on the back end to capture bulk scoring in ways that the field is not. So that part is kind of understood, I think, by the field at this point. What is kind of being missed, I think, is that we have to kind of also incorporate our governing constraint. And our governing constraint in these contests is ADP. And historically speaking, ADP at the running back position is going to see the greatest magnitude in fluctuations throughout a draft cycle. And I label a draft cycle as like when the contest opens to when it closes. That's all the time we have to draft. And within that draft cycle, historically speaking, we're going to see the highest magnitude of ADP movements at running back because it's a function of the value at the position being so closely tied to volume. And that is going to change with different news cycles. Like we're coming up on a major a change in that news cycle right now with camp about to start. We're going to see shakeups and depth charts. We're going to see coach speak. We're going to see who's running with the ones, who's running with the twos, who's not running at all. Injuries news. We're going to see injuries during camp. We're going to see updates on injuries in the past. Like how's Breece Hall looking? How's Derrick Henry looking with his age? Like all these things are about to like be magnified. So that is going to drive ADP pretty heavily at the running back position. So both of those things kind of combine to like our draft strategy probably shouldn't be static. Like it shouldn't be zero running back is the way to go or hero or anchor or however we want to label these things. It probably should change with time and information. So that has led me, I've been extremely heavy in best ball up to this point. Through about 350 drafts, I've been extremely heavy in zero and anchor or hero running back teams. So like zero or one running back through the first seven rounds or so. Up to this point, trying to leverage all of that we just talked about, that's probably going to change here as we enter camp this coming week, where we might see like it be more beneficial from an EV perspective. Again, we talk in EV because it's the only thing we can control. It might be more beneficial to shift that to now looking at the fallers that have fallen at the running back position up to this point and going heavy or whatever the case may be. It's a very, very convoluted and complex question, brings a very complex answer type deal. But to me, up to this point, yeah, I've been extremely zero running back, hero, anchor, and that's going to change here in the next week or so.
No, I think that's a really, really good point. And I also think to add to that with the training camp news and what's going to go on with hype trains and such. And honestly, some of it is justified at the end of the day, right? Like, it's not that, like, all hype trains crash. Like some of them are totally fine and reasonable. Yeah. I mean, look at like Isaiah Pacheco a few years ago. Like he ended up being, you know, he wasn't like an amazing fantasy asset, but down the stretch, he was getting more and more points. And that was after, you know, he was turning heads in camp. Like it was a big moment for him. And we've seen, but then on the flip side, we've seen like Amir Abdullah, you know, go in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
You know, when his hype train was getting out of control. But yeah. I do think that what's important and what you're saying is, you know, with the volume piece is that I've always kind of preached it as the running back position is more of a coaching decision as opposed to what we're going to get at wide receiver and tight end, because wide receiver and tight end inherently, there's just a little bit more talent that needs to be there for those wide receivers and tight ends to get targets, to get open, and to be part of that game plan. Whereas a running back just needs to be on the field. Like Matt LaFleur can come out and say, I'm not splitting this backfield or I am splitting this backfield. And that's going to dramatically change the way that we view those two running backs in that backfield. Whereas if he says, we're going to be a little bit more run heavy this year, or we're going to be a little bit more pass heavy this year, I don't know if that's going to dramatically change the way that we view the wide receivers on that team, you know, because it's not as tangible, right? And so I do think that's really, really important that as the months go on, knowing the information that we have you know, at hand at that moment while we're drafting and how that can change is really important. And obviously, if you go with a zero RB approach, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you go with a zero RB approach, what you're saying is I'm getting my running backs late and they also then have an opportunity then to hypothetically rise in value from when I drafted them in June. Like, let's say you're getting a lot of Kamani Vidal right now or something like that, who's, you know, 13th, 14th round. And then all of a sudden they come out and they say he's crushing it in camp. He's going to be the RB1 and he's an 8th round pick or 9th round pick or something by the end of August. Like, that's a lot of equity gained in that pick because of the information that you were using. Actually, it's because you're sort of opposing the information that you had at that time and saying, we don't have enough information on these backfields. So I'm just going to kind of lean into that and go with later round running backs. Does that kind of play into it as well?
Yeah, 100%. And there's a layer that kind of goes beyond that as well, in that, like, how we construct our rosters in that period of uncertainty. And humans are like we're really bad at dealing and handling with uncertainty. We're like creatures of comfort. We like to have our hand in play, like hand in things. We want to feel in control, right? So this, like, this time, this period of uncertainty, we're really, really hard, or we're really bad at handling that and dealing with that. Why I say that is typically when you see zero running back teams built early, before camp, you're seeing, like, say Underdog, for example, where we're constrained to 18 draft picks, you're seeing 6, 7, 8 running back rosters built, right? Well, you're simultaneously saying that I'm going to leverage this variance, but I'm also going to hedge against that, if that makes sense. So I've been a big proponent this season of saying, like, if we're drafting as if we're right, and that's kind of the buzz phrase over the last year and a half in best ball, like, draft as if you're right, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're not drafting as if you're right by taking 6, 7, 8 running backs on a zero running back build. You're saying, you're kind of just throwing stuff at a wall and seeing what sticks. That leaves holes theoretically at your other positions. If you were drafting zero running back as if you were right in May, June, July timeframe, you would stop at 5 running backs because that is what we know is the biggest boost to EV in this format. So, like other examples, you mentioned the Chargers. We have a lot of uncertainty in Tennessee. We have a lot of uncertainty in Cincinnati, Dallas. And some of these offenses we expect them to score points this year. Like, they're all those offenses, except the Chargers maybe, are projected currently to be in the top 10 in points scored. So those are probably valuable situations. So if we kind of reverse engineer all that and consider all of that, like all the theoretics that go into that, now it's this case of, if you're taking Zach Moss, act as if he's going to be a top 10 back this year. Yeah. If you're taking Zeke, you're saying by taking him that he's going to return like RB2 numbers this year. And if that's the case, you don't need 7, 8 running backs on that roster. So it's this weird kind of comfort level. We're not good at being uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting in my draft guide, and I say this every year, the number one thing is to lean into uncertainty because the market hates uncertainty. Like, rookie, especially in like managed season long leagues and your home leagues and stuff like that, rookies and second year players where we don't have a lot of information on those guys, they're always massive values in season long leagues because what's funny is once you get to the late rounds, that's when people start drafting all these rookies because they're like, oh yeah, it's a double digit round pick. I don't care. But realistically, you should be leaning into that uncertainty more so throughout your draft. My one question, my one follow up to that is there seems to be though still a balance, correct, of like looking at what would be optimal, right? Which would like in hindsight optimal. And what I mean by that is, you know, you're saying like, let's say you go with like a 2, 5, 8, 3 build. Is that, that would add up to 18. Yeah. And you go with something like that. And, but your 5 running backs are kind of zero RBE type running backs, right? Like you don't have an anchor. Your RB1 is Zach Moss. Maybe you get like a Tajay Spears in there or something like that. In hindsight, definitely would make sense to say, this would be the optimal way that you should have drafted this past year because some of those running backs are naturally going to hit, right? Mm-hmm. But in terms of forecasting, is there any wiggle room for us to say, let's get 6 running backs? You know, if we know that 5 is optimal, let's get 6, maybe not 7 or 8. Maybe that's like the part where you think it's a little bit overboard. Hopefully I'm making sense here.
Yeah.
But, you know, like where we recognize that we're trying to be optimal based on the way things end up going down and looking at things in hindsight and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, we're obviously still forecasting to some degree, and there's not going to be necessarily this powerhouse to the nth degree lineup and a team out there that just hits on literally everything, especially in these contests where the playoffs happen, and there's these playoff structures where it adds a little bit of variance because you could be squeaking in and then just having these blow up week 15 to 17 matchups. So my question to make that even short, to shorten that, I know that these questions have been horribly, horribly phrased so far today. My question is, do you think there is a little bit of wiggle room to play the variance game, to say, I know this isn't necessarily exactly how things are going to go down, while also playing to what you're saying and saying we should be drafting based on, these guys actually hitting?
Yes. And I think it comes down to our understanding and how we define optimal, because I think that this term has been misused for a long time. Mm-hmm. Optimal is the exact path on that game tree, that massive array, that tree of potential outcomes that maximizes points when they matter. In a playoff style contest, that is advancement, or that is week 17 and then advancement rate and then week 16 and then week 15. That's the contributors to EV. So like this idea of optimal, knowing that there is one optimal path on the game tree this season and that we don't know that, we also have to understand that we don't need optimal in order to win, because we're not playing these contests against a supercomputer. We're not playing against a time machine. We're playing against other inherently flawed human beings, right? So, yeah. I mean, the way that I kind of describe this idea of optimal versus what we can do to win is, look at like the Millie Maker on DraftKings. And we'll just use that contest because there are anywhere between 250 to 470,000 entries every single week, right?
Yeah.
The optimal roster on a given week, and this is what, 14 years of the Millie Maker being in existence, times 17 to 18 full slates on a year, there has never been an optimal roster that has won a DFS contest. So, or the Millie Maker for that matter. So we know that going into this, we don't need optimal to win. So that gives us, from a theoretical angle, the leeway to introduce deviations. And a deviation is any departure from optimal theory. And by definition, any deviation from optimal theory is going to incur a subsequent dip in EV. We know this. But we also have to also take into account field tendencies, because we can turn those deviations into exploits, which is a fancy way of saying what I'm doing away from optimal is something that the field is not doing enough based on its hit rate. So in DFS, we have things like quarterback and tight end pairings, because tight end is naturally going to derive a lot of its value from touchdowns, which directly correlates to the quarterback. We also have seen things over the past 2 years like quarterback plus running back plus pass catcher. The hit rate of that, and I'm basing this again off of the winning roster in the Millie Maker, the hit rate of that is like 22.2% over a 2 year sample. So the fact that, or now we take that reasoning and say, is the field utilizing quarterback plus running back plus pass catcher at a 22.2% frequency? The answer is probably not. Right. I don't know. We don't have that data right now, but the answer is probably not. And speaking to best ball, we don't have that data. But making the assumption that the field is not drafting these things that have proven hit rates at that frequency gives us the leeway to say, hey, that might be an exploit where the hit rate is greater than the field's utilization. We know it's not optimal. We know that if very rarely you're going to see an optimal roster have quarterback plus running back plus a pass catcher or a quarterback plus a tight end, but we know that the hit rate is greater than the field's utilization. So that those things kind of give us the leeway to make those exploits. And we don't have the math behind currently, because we have all of four data points here. We don't have the math to say like, what's the magnitude of the deviation, or what matters most in round 14? Is it week 17 correlation? Is it closing line value versus ADP? Like, we don't have the math to work that out. But we can confidently say there are things that we can do away from optimal theory to give us these exploits. So that is kind of what the bulk of my work in best ball over the last three seasons has been, is like, what can we do different than the field to give us boost to EV where the field just kind of isn't paying attention to it?
Yeah. So basically you don't need to draft seven running backs in these kind of builds because your running back room doesn't have to be optimal in order for you to win, but it can still be very, very good even with those five running backs, essentially.
Correct. Yeah. And that's going to change with time and what the field is doing and ADP and all those things and information. So that's kind of like what I mean by, hey, our plan of attack or our game plan in these contests should probably change as time is and we get more information.
Yeah. Speaking of time and speaking of the word optimal, do you find that there is an optimal time? This is kind of a different definition of optimal in a way, but an optimal time to draft in Best Ball Mania, because Best Ball Mania obviously starts in May. It'll go through most of August. And then how do you choose which time that you're sort of investing the most? Or, you know, obviously there's a time constraint here where, you know, we all have lives. We can't just like say, oh, I'm going to draft all 150 teams on July 30th and that's it. But have you found that there is a time that you favor a little bit more? Like, are you drafting more teams late in the summer, early in the summer?
I personally, my habit pattern is to kind of break them up into thirds. And I break it up into these time pockets of information. So I call the draft cycle, we talked about it earlier, the total time that we can draft in a particular contest. I break that draft cycle up into individual draft windows, and I do that based on the amount of information that we have. So draft window one is like from when the contest opens till the start of training camp, which we're about coming up to. It's very, very flat, the amount of information that we have. You know, you'll see stuff from OTAs. You'll see it's like, okay, they're running routes with no pads against nobody. Yeah. So what information does that give me? So it's kind of a flat information bucket there. The second information bucket or draft window that I utilize is the opening of camp to the start of the preseason. We get more information. We see things like injuries. We see things like depth chart breakdowns. And then my third draft window or bucket is the end of training camp and the start of preseason until the start of the NFL season. So a short 3.5 weeks this year with the removal of one of those preseason games. So the reason I do that is because there's different information. If there's different information, again, back to this idea that we should probably be more dynamic in our draft strategies, what I've seen is that the field is kind of flat in the way that they are drafting. And it as we just talked about, so much is changing in those different draft windows that so too should our draft strategy. So if I'm a casual, if I've allocated, hey, I'm going to throw 25 entries into the BBM, I would most likely want to save those entries until I have the most information. So until my draft window three, after the start of preseason. If I understand that these cycles are different and that my strategy should change, I probably want to be even spread in those three draft windows. Last year, I maxed the BBM on like June 20th or something, like super early.
Wow.
Because I noticed that the field was kind of flat in their draft strategies and they were not embracing enough variance because of all the uncertainty in the early draft window. So by doing that, like, I just exponentially increased the variance associated with my portfolio. And yeah, I didn't win anything. Like, my advancement rate was super low. But I understood that, like, you have to be willing to embrace more variance when we have less information. So like, the answer to that question is like, it depends on each person. It depends on how you are comfortable managing variance, how you are comfortable embracing things that the field might not be embracing. If you are like this player that kind of just wants information and then make the best decision with that information, it's probably best to wait until like the second week of August through the start of the NFL season to draft your contest, like your entire portfolio.
Yeah.
If you have this like understanding that like, we should be changing how we approach things with fewer or less information, more variance. Like, yeah, it's totally fine to draft early a big portion of your portfolio. So it all depends on the individual and kind of how your personal understanding of the theoretics behind all this are, and kind of your comfort level with embracing variance, I would say.
Yeah, I love that answer. I probably should have asked this when we were talking about running back builds, but I've seen you talk about it a little bit, and I think you tweeted about it a little bit as well. And we've seen others sort of embrace this strategy and this tactic in these earlier best ball drafts. I guess it's not as early anymore because we're mid-July at this point, but yeah. I've seen the three running back builds and basically be done at the position, maybe get, you know, a guy in the 16th or 17th or something like that. But what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think that obviously any strategy can quote unquote work, you know, if things break the right way, but do you think that it's plus EV? Do you think it's optimal? Are human optimal, if you will, to get those three running backs at the start of your draft?
I would argue that the optimal path on the game tree probably, or has a good chance of being, three running backs. It's probably two to three quarterbacks, two to three tight ends, three running backs, and the rest wide receivers.
Yeah.
But again, there's that discussion of like, we don't necessarily need optimal to win these things, and we don't know what optimal is on the game tree, and there's one optimal path. So you would have to get like the exact three running backs that stay healthy the entire season. So like, while that is probably optimal, the variance associated with that is off the charts. Like, you, and the other thing I think that we need to understand with this discussion is we talk in EV terms because that's all we can control. It removes variance. But the tertiary piece to that is EV assumes an infinite sample size. We don't have that. We have the sample size of one. And in the entire existence of best ball, we have a sample size of 8, something like that. And in the entire existence of underdog, we have a sample size of 4. So like, that's not enough to draw these like sweeping conclusions. But people, and this is kind of the typical response I get when I post a three running back build, and I do it for a very specific reason that we need to kind of open our minds to, like, we don't really know what optimal, true optimal is at this point. But when the responses I get are like, oh, nice, thanks for paying the rake, I can never win. It's like, well, if this sample were infinite, this would win at a higher rate than anything else. But we know that, like, yeah, it hasn't won yet. Okay, we have a sample size of 4. So there's a very, very nuanced discussion to be had there. It is probably optimal to draft three running backs only. The variance associated with that, because the injury rates at the position and the fact that we could see a coach mid-season, you know, look at Dallas last year. It was like, they entered the season like, we want to be a run first team. And up until their bye week, they tried to do that. And then they got to their bye week and they reassessed. They're like, hey, this isn't working. We're just going to air it out. And then they like set historical rates for pass rates the rest of the year. So like, that can also change. That's part of variance. Like, so there's so much that we can't control that, yes, from a practical standpoint, the most EV that we can get from a roster is having 5 running backs. Any deviation away from that, we have to realize that that is going to incur a hit to EV, but can we do things within that to like make up that EV through these exploits? And that's kind of what's fun to explore, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, look, if you were to tell me who the best three running backs, in terms of the full season production and playoff production, if you told me who they were, I'd go with a three running back build using those guys, you know, all day long. Like you said, like that would be the path to be able to have that optimal lineup. But it's asking a lot. And it's also asking a lot, you know, I mean, this is more of like a subjective human psychology thing, but like, what are the odds that they would all just be first round, second round, third round type? You know what I mean? Like just those backs and the way that a lot of people draft in that way. There's always going to be like a Zach Moss or some middle round back that ends up being what that dude,
Kyren Williams,
that dude would be. Yeah, Kyren Williams last year, right?
Yeah. So like, yeah, exactly. That's the other thing is like, humans are very, very bad at predicting the future.
Yes.
So like, yeah, like Sam Laporta, 11th, 12th rounder last year, all off season. Kyren Williams was undrafted and then came into like the 16th round.
Right.
Tank Dell, like the list goes on from last year. we also have to like be honest with the fact that like that was probably a 99% outcome, having 5-6 players in the last 4 or 5 rounds that are every week contributors. That was probably like that might not happen again for the next 100 years, right? Using that data point of last season as like a determining factor in how we base our decisions this year is probably also a mistake. So, that discussion goes on and on and on, like into this discussion of variance versus optimal. But that's kind of there's just so much that we can't control, and we are very, very bad at predicting the future.
Yeah, 100%. Let's talk quarterback a little bit. It feels like the market at quarterback is relatively efficient in terms of how we would project, you know, in terms of the positional ranks, not necessarily like where they go in the draft, but just, you know, within the position and where they get drafted. Is there really a way, like me personally, and I'm asking this selfishly as someone who's becoming a best ball bro and hopefully will be a best ball bro by the end of the summer.
Yeah.
I've found that my quarterback portfolio is incredibly flat, right? Like I don't have strong takes, and it's really just driven by stacking and the guy, like I have a lot of Will Levis, for instance. It's not like I'm sitting here thinking that Will Levis is going to light the world on fire. I just really like where DeAndre Hopkins goes in drafts. Right. And so I pair him up, and he's a very cheap way of getting a stack. How are you, if you are differentiating at quarterback, or is it a similar thing for you where you're kind of just getting the guys who work with your running backs and wide receivers and tight ends?
No, I think that's a very nuanced discussion as well, but I'll kind of try and make it as concise as possible. If we had an infinite sample size, like the theoretical optimal way to draft would be as flat as possible at every position. And we would just look to leverage variance in our favor. That would also assume that like our portfolio could also be infinite. So we know we don't have that. We know we have a sample size of one this season. We know that we have a limited amount of entries that we can put in these. So at the quarterback position, it is easiest to be flatter or more in line with that optimal theory because we know that the position as a whole is more condensed as far as scoring goes. It is flatter scoring position. So theoretically, that is the optimal way to approach that. I kind of, because the field is kind of taking this approach of being more flat. I mean, you look at like people who are screenshotting their exposures, like 80, 90% frequency, you're going to see like, all right, they have everybody between 16 and 6%. That's a fairly accurate assumption of the field, right? At that point. So I actually go the other way with it because the field is so flat. That is one of the exploits that I can introduce is like, let me take stands on the quarterback position. And I do that by not looking at season long rankings, production or projections, because that is going to be, again, on an infinite sample, very, very flat. Yeah. What I'm doing is I'm looking for weekly range of outcomes because this is a weekly game and the field is generally treating these things through the lens of season long. How is ADP how is the first iteration of ADP introduced? Well, they take season long projections and they rank them, and then there's your ADP. And then we see human bias and influence those, and shift around ADP. But basically, I guess without going too much further into this rabbit hole, because we could talk for hours and hours, JJ, is I will take some more exploitative stances personally at the quarterback position because we know it to be flat and we know that the field kind of understands that. And we're getting into the realm of a theoretical concept called Nash equilibrium, which is this area of game theory where no one player can gain an appreciable edge over another by anything in that certain aspect of the game. So probably the position that is approaching Nash equilibrium or getting as close as possible to it is at quarterback. Secondary would probably be running back because we understand all the variance and how we gain value. And then like wide receiver and tight end are like way down the road, like trying to play catch up. So if the field is drafting one way at a high frequency at quarterback and running back, that is where theoretically I'm going to take the most of my stances. So for me, I look at weekly range of outcomes at the position. And that'll give me tiebreakers between guys like, for example, Kyler Murray, Dak Prescott, Joe Burrow. I mean, they're all back-to-back-to-back in ADP at the quarterback position, right? Well, Kyler Murray, historically, is being drafted in season-long where he is because he has a dope floor. I mean, right. He has like 4 to 6 points that you can bank on weekly just from rushing. But where do quarterbacks derive their value in fantasy from? And I did a study on this, and I found that the highest correlative function of production at the quarterback position is total touchdowns. Not like rushing production, not yards on the ground, not rushing scores, total touchdowns. And in order, there's a magic number of touchdowns. In order to have a chance at the overall QB1 in a season, the magic number is 40 touchdowns. So there are very few quarterbacks now that have a chance to score 40 touchdowns. And I mentioned Joe Burrow and Dak Prescott and Kyler Murray in that discussion because Kyler has almost, sub 5% chance of scoring 40 touchdowns this year. Whereas like Joe Burrow and Dak Prescott probably have 50% chance of scoring 40 touchdowns. So from a weekly perspective, it's much more likely that we're going to see more spike weeks. And again, this is best ball. So much more spike weeks coming from guys like Joe Burrow and Dak Prescott compared to guys like Kyler Murray. And the way that I kind of drive this discussion home is look at Anthony Richardson last year. Everybody says, well, he led the league in fantasy points at quarterback per four quarters played. It's like, yes, he did. He also scored 7 touchdowns. He scored 7 touchdowns in just over like 2 games worth of play. And that's crazy. That's probably not going to be replicated this season. But like, yeah, 4 of those touchdowns came on the ground. This dude was balling. So that whole discussion kind of comes down to that will kind of be the deciding factor or a major portion of my decision-making process at quarterback is weekly range of outcomes. And in order for a quarterback to have a high weekly ceiling, which is so much more important to us in best ball, he's got to score touchdowns. So if we could say, if you want to like dumb this down as simple as possible, like draft quarterbacks on offenses that are expected to be in the top 10 in the league. That's it.
Yeah. And it also leads to the discussion. And I kind of want to touch on this because I think it's really important. I talk about this in my draft guide. I've talked about it for a few years now. Is I do think there's a misunderstanding of mobility and quarterback rushing in fantasy football where it is good. It's a very good thing. But like when Rich Rebar wrote about the Konami code back in 2013, it was about Tim Tebow and Terrell Pryor. And it was about this idea that those guys are horrific passers who can still be fantasy relevant because of their rushing. That is a floor argument, right? It's not a ceiling argument, right? The difference now with like Josh Allen or even Lamar, because Lamar obviously has had these like crazy touchdown rate seasons and stuff as a passer, is that they're good passers too. Like that's what's really elevating these guys to being elite. And the difference, you know, I think there is a very, very big difference here between, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, between season long and best ball. And this has been a really big thing for me to like kind of switch, because I'm obviously, I got season long brain and I'm always thinking about it from that perspective. But and I think we conversed about this a little bit on Twitter the one day, but I think it's really, really important for people to recognize that in season long, the mobility, the quarterback rushing, what's so great about that is the predictability aspect of it. We know going into a season and then going into a game, who those quarterbacks are going to be every year. And that's why the R squared between ADP and points per game at quarterback has just increased, you know, over the last 5 years versus the previous 5, previous 10. But the thing that needs to be sort of reconciled with best ball is this idea that the rushing quarterbacks don't necessarily have a higher weekly ceiling than the immobile, the pocket passers do. And then on top of that, if the pocket passer, you know, if his team scores 3 touchdowns and all 3 of those touchdowns are on the ground and that pocket passer sucks that one day, well, you have a backup plan. You have another quarterback that could hypothetically step in and give you some production in a 2 quarterback build, because you're not building with 1 quarterback and you don't have that security blanket when you're playing in your season long league. And so the floor at quarterback actually does matter a little bit more in season long because you're not able to have that security blanket. Is that what you've looked at and what you've researched, and would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. When we're making lineup decisions, we value floor at a different weight than when we're talking about best ball, where the computer is generating our lineup.
Yeah.
It is so much more beneficial to think about the top 20% of a player's weekly range of outcomes in best ball, because that now contributes. I mean, look at last year on Drafters, which is a cumulative scoring format. You look at like the top 10 rosters that were in that format. Like six of the top 10 rosters last year had Devon Achane because he had a 51-point game.
Yeah.
Like that's you, it's hard to make the up that. Like
in a
season long perspective, you play against Devon Achane, you lost that week. That's overcomable. Like you can overcome that. In a best ball function or a format, like it's really, really hard to overcome a 51 burger across a 17-week sample where we're adding up all the points that you score. So yeah, it's definitely different. And if we want to like put a bow on this discussion of mobility, like Lamar Jackson owns like Lamar Jackson and Joe Burrow are the two quarterbacks that own the highest rate of overall QB1 performances over the last three seasons. If you look at Lamar Jackson and just compare like his blow up weeks, he scored 4 or 5 touchdowns every time he was the overall quarterback one. So like, yeah, two of those might've come on the ground in a given week, but like you have to score touchdowns at quarterback in order to reach these higher end outcomes in a range of outcomes. So like I love Will Levis too. I am, he is in my top three in exposure. And like we talked about, like my top three is not 16%. It is 30%.
Yeah.
The reason why is I project the Tennessee Titans to outperform their current projections.
Yep.
So that's a very different discussion than saying like, why are you not drafting Drake May at the same frequency? Well, it's like, yeah, he is mobile. He set the NCAA record for like rushing score, all that stuff. Like notwithstanding, the New England Patriots have probably a top 5 defense on paper. They have so many changes on their offensive side of the ball. They have a head coach who is coming from the defensive side, his first year as a head coach. They have new coordinator. Like there's so much going on there that like we shouldn't expect New England to vastly outperform from an offensive perspective. Whereas Tennessee getting like a Kyle Shanahan coaching tree guy or a by extension Gary Kubiak coaching tree guy, that can lead to a situation where they're passing more and they're in the red zone more and they have the opportunity to score more touchdowns. So I just break it all down into weekly range of outcomes and then kind of factor that in, I think, at a heavier rate than the field is doing.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I'm glad we were able to talk about it because I know we went back and forth a little bit. And now it's like very clear, and the whole time we were agreeing with one another, which is great.
Yeah, it's hard to get that, you know, in 260 characters or like a thread of tweets. Like, let's jam about it.
yeah, exactly. Let me ask you this: what do you think is the biggest mistake that you see best ball players make?
I think it's being too rigid. And we talked about it a little bit earlier where so much is changing throughout the draft cycle. And then even more is going to change like once we get to the season. And us as humans, like trying to feign this idea of control in a contest that has, we already talked about the game tree, borderline infinite potential outcomes, and now borderline infinite variance. I mean, like, look at last season, like 30% of the quarterbacks across the NFL got injured and were out for extended periods of time.
Yeah.
And that's at the position that has the lowest historic injury rate. So like there's so much we can't control. So thinking that we can control more than we can and being too rigid and saying, I'm going to draft every team zero RB or I'm going to draft every team hero running back, this is the way you win, I think is the biggest mistake because there's just so many variables.
Yeah. Yeah, the other thing too is that when you go with the same team structure over and over again, that means that your player portfolio is going to look more and more like you're not going to get the exposure. Like you might like one of my flaws right now is the fourth round. I haven't just because of team build. Like, I want more Isaiah Pacheco than I've drafted, you know? It's just that, and now obviously his ADP is rising, so it's becoming, you know, more and more difficult, of course. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, like, you go, you get in a rhythm of doing the same team builds, and then you realize, oh, there's a player that I actually like, you know, independently of everything else, who I'm just kind of forcing out because I'm forcing myself to go with an elite tight end or something in that range. And I think that's really, really important. I think it speaks to the rigidity that you're talking to, you know, with that answer. One last thing before I let you go. We haven't done that much in terms of player takes. This has been much more game theory driven. So I'll just ask you, give me a handful of players, two, three, who you seem to be drafting most right now and that you think you'll have high exposure to this year.
My highest exposure through those 350 drafts-ish, and I looked this up before, is Cooper Kupp at about 60%, which seems crazy. 2 weeks ago, it was 70%. Like, so it's come down a little bit. Cooper Kupp, Jonnu Smith, and Khalif Raymond. And the kind of the similarities of those three is they're all on top expected offenses. And like we're the Rams, the Dolphins, and the Lions. And they're all expected to be on the field almost every single play. And they're all depressed in ADP up to this point. I think the gap between Puka Nacua and Cooper Kupp is way bigger than it should be. I think they should be both treated kind of as like the 1A as pass catchers instead of a clear one and two. Jonnu Smith is like, he was sought out by Mike McDaniel. He brought him in for a specific reason. Like, yes, up to this, the 2 year sample we have in Miami, Mike McDaniel has utilized, has been highly concentrated, has been like Tyreek Hill and Jalen Waddle, and then the running back room. But like, what else did they have? They never had a wide receiver three. They never had a tight end because Mike Gesicki is not him. Sorry.
Right.
And so like now they have a wide receiver three and they've got two. They drafted one in Malik Washington and they have another that they went out and signed in OBJ. And they have a tight end that they went out and got for a very specific reason. I think that reason is he is extremely big. He's extremely fast and he's extremely athletic. Like, okay, Mike McDaniel, go have fun with that. So yeah, I want to kind of be early on that. And then with Khalif Raymond, like it's four players that are being drafted, position or skill position players, in on the Lions. It's like you have Amon-Ra, you have Sam Laporta, and then you have the two running backs. It's like Khalif Raymond's probably going to be on the field at an 85% clip. He's probably going to be in a route at a 90-95% clip. So I just want to buy into that with a last round pick that doesn't mean really much of anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the Khalif Raymond call out. He's someone that to me, it's like, if you need a little bit more exposure to that stack, especially that week 17 game, very easy click. And then the Jonnu thing, I got pushback for my Jonnu love on another show because people were talking about Mike Gesicki and saying, you know, it's like, oh, well they had Mike Gesicki. Why didn't they use Gesicki more? Because they've been dead last in tight end target share in each of the last 2 years.
Yeah.
I see it total like Jonnu Smith is not the same tight end as Mike Gesicki is. Mike Gesicki's a slot receiver, essentially, you know, playing tight end. Jonnu Smith is much more of the traditional type. And I think that McDaniel is going after him because of the yak ability. Like that's what the whole offense is sort of predicated on, right? And like that's what Jonnu Smith does so well. You get Tyreek and Jalen Waddle getting vertical, you get Jonnu Smith underneath a little bit to create that yak. I mean, it makes a ton of sense from a fit perspective. And again, it's he's stackable, it's a good offense, all that good stuff, and he's going late. So I'm totally with you on all of those players. Mark, this has been awesome. People are going to love this. Let everyone know where they can find you and all this awesome game theory work that you're doing.
Yeah, we just launched. Well, I primarily work at 1 week season. It is DFS centric. But last year, I headed up the initial launch of our Best Ball Plus product, which Best Ball, obviously. And so we're in year two of that. Head on over to 1 week season, get signed up for Best Ball Plus if you're looking for some more theoretic stuff. I also work at Player Profiler, Roto World, and Fantasy Points. So check out my work there as well.
All over the place, man. I really, really appreciate your time. As always, everyone, you can check out the Late Round Draft Guide over on lateround.com. Make sure you're taking advantage of the promo code Late Round over on Underdog. You will get a free Late Round Draft Guide when you do so and when you sign up with that promo code and make a deposit. Otherwise, thank you for tuning in.